This is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Larry Mueller, along with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And if you wonder why animals do some of the crazy things they do, give us a call right now. Our number is 1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. Among the calls this hour, we'll have another topic to share. And what are we talking about this time, Patricia?
Well, given the heated controversy about animal adoption policies following the brouhaha with Ellen DeGeneres' dog, remember that, Mueller?
Yep.
I thought it was a good time to talk about what to look for in a good shelter or a good rescue group.
That is a very important topic, and I can't wait to hear what you have to think about it, too. And still ahead, we'll welcome a guest to tell us what birding was like in the days before binoculars and field guides. But first, let's take some calls. The number 1-800-462-7413. And here's our first caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, how you doing, Larry and Patricia?
Great. Who are we speaking with?
My name's Eric. I'm in Meridian, Idaho.
Eric, thanks a lot for calling. What can we do for you?
About a year ago, we got a cat. Her name is Minnie. She's 1 year old, and she's in a very loving home with four kids in it. About a month ago or so, a little over a month ago, she decided to just leave for 2 weeks. I'm not sure if she went on vacation. She went to Vegas or New Jersey. She didn't take the car, but she was gone for 2 weeks. And just as we were starting to give up hope and we were thinking about putting up posters, lo and behold, one of our friends a couple blocks away found her and returned her to us. So we are the proud re-owners of Minnie the cat once again.
Good. But I'm glad she's home.
We are, too. We were wondering if she was going out and partying or what. We didn't know what she was doing for those 2 weeks she was gone, but that it brings up a bigger issue, which is that Minnie the cat loves to hang out near our front door, and whenever we leave or come in, she is ready to just dash outside. And we really need to find a way to prevent Minnie from dashing outside, you know, short of saying no more Nintendo, no more television, no more DVDs, no more internet.
Take away your car keys.
Car keys, exactly. We don't want to go to that extent here. So what's a happy medium, Patricia and Larry here?
You know, it's a good question, and it's a tough one. I have, one, had a cat like that myself. I do now. Her name is Sushi, and I have had clients who've had cats like that. And it, for people who haven't had one of these escape artists, they are immeasurably fast. Just the speed of light, basically bolting between your legs and out the door. So here are a couple ideas for you. One, your cat loves to be outside. So think about, is there a safe way? Can you create an outdoor, maybe a fence or enclosed area, kind of a little kitty patio that's outside in your backyard so your cat can go outside, so she can be outside, not kill wild animals and not get lost and hurt and never come back again? That's going to take some of the pressure off that front door, which is obviously a door you can't not open. So one, try and figure out a way to get her needs met, but out the back door. In terms of the front door, there are a couple of things you can do. One is you can teach her that every time you go to that door and you put your hand on the knob, that's actually a cue to her that there's going to be a piece of chicken appearing behind her. Mm-hmm. So it's really easy. You go to the front door, you put your hand on the knob, and you throw a piece of her favorite food, a little tiny piece, behind her away from the door. So you do that over and over and over again. And if she's able to go outside the back door, that might be enough. But with some cats, I want to warn you, it's not going to be. And I'll tell you about one thing I did with somebody's cat that was very successful is basically we set it up such that I was outside the front door. The owner opened the front door, and the timing was really critical here to get it right. And this is really important to have some kind of a safety net in case it doesn't work. But basically, as the cat was just about to bolt out the front door, this is a really high-tech procedure, Larry. I had two pot lids. I'm not kidding you. That is how high-tech I was. And I basically banged them together like cymbals. And there's good news and bad news in that. One, the good news is that the cat was stunned, turned around, ran the other way, and never tried to get out the front door again. The bad news is that I didn't think to wear earplugs.
I was going
to
say, did your hearing get affected by that?
Several, many, many hair cells in Trisha's hearing canal were destroyed. So be cautious with that.
And, you know, I've got a pet tip, or we have a pet tip from Judy from Onalaska, Texas, that relates to this.
Great.
She wrote in to tell us how she kept her cat from rushing the door to leave the house. And she says any time her cat Einstein saw her by the kitchen door, it's the only outside door she uses, he would get in position to bolt. So in response, Judy taught Einstein the command, out of the kitchen, and used a spray bottle of water to back up the command. And Judy continued to teach Einstein the command even as she tried to leave the house while Einstein was in another room. What's more, she also used the command when entering her home so the cat wouldn't charge out the door from the other side. Einstein finally caught on and no longer charges the door. Judy says, out of the kitchen. That command also comes in handy when Einstein decides to beg for food while she's cooking supper.
This is good. This is a great tip. I love that. Thanks, Judy. That's wonderful. Basically, you're using operant conditioning, putting a behavior on cue, go away from the door. And the spray idea makes me think you could set up this door opening you could get your garden hose and spray the cat with a garden hose if he or she, Minnie, decides to run out the door. That might be a little damp in the living room, though. Anyway, a bunch of good ideas for you. Let us know. Let us know how it goes.
Thanks, Eric.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Good luck. And by the way, for pet tips, that was a great one. And we get lots of good ones.
It's wonderful. We love hearing from listeners like you. Please email us at pets@wpr.org.
And if you'd like to join in by phone, you can do that right now at 1-800-462-7413. And someone's online. Let's go to the phones. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Thank you. This is Steve from Vienna, Virginia.
Steve, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, I have a 3-year-old dog, Blackie, who is a Border Collie Retriever mix, a wonderful dog, very, very wonderful dog. We love him immensely. Ever since I can remember, when the leash would come out or when we'd go to take him for a walk, he would immediately hunt around and grab a sock to take with him. Typically, the riper, the better. And he would keep that sock in his mouth until sometime during the walk he got interested in something else, and it was his view that I should be the one to take it back in.
Right.
And he would leave it, and I would take it back in. And that was consistent from the time, again, about as long as I can remember. And, you know, at one point we thought of trying to break him of that habit, but then we figured, well, you know, he's such a good dog. He doesn't have to necessarily be a perfect dog, and he seems to like it. And besides, he eventually learned to go into the hamper to get socks, and it seemed as though that was going to be a losing battle anyway. And that, in fact, turned out to be a good decision because as he got older, if there were times when we were, you know, perhaps overnight or when we were otherwise occupied and he had an urgent need to go out, he would go and get a sock and he would bring it to us. And that was a terrific way of telling us that, you know, it was time to drop what we were doing. Unless he was going to drop something, and then we'd be doing that.
Right.
So my question is, why does he bring the sock with him? Is that something that he does for comfort, or is it a habit? We've always wondered about it, and I thought that I would ask you.
You know, it's a great question, and I can tell you a couple other examples. There's a Border Collie who used to compete in herding dog trials with a stick in his mouth. And if he didn't have the stick in his mouth, he just fell apart. He just couldn't. And you've rarely seen anything look goofier, frankly, than a Border Collie trying to be cool, you know, and walk up on a flock of sheep and impress them with his big stick sticking out of his mouth.
Better than a cigarette.
A big cigar. But I see a lot of dogs do that, and I think you might have hit the nail on the head. Obviously, we're speculating here. We can't ask them. But if you look at the dogs who do it most, it's retrievers. And if you look at what we've done, we've selected for dogs who are basically obsessed with having things in their mouth. So that's part of it. But I think you're right. I think there's a kind of a comfort factor. You know how some people often will do something similar. They'll carry something with us. Larry and I, although actually I shouldn't say Larry and I. Oh, no, he is doing it. Larry is playing with a paperclip. And I would play with my paperclip, which, honest to goodness, the producer actually puts out for us, except I've already destroyed my paperclip already. So that, you know, we do that as a way of sort of keeping your brain activated in such a way that you're calmed and soothed while you're doing something else. So I think you hit the nail on the head about it being something related to comfort.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah.
Thanks for calling, Steve. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Well, I'll tell you what, here's the number for you to call if you'd like to join in, 1-800-462-7413. We're going to be talking about adoption coming up next here. Still not sure where to adopt your next pet? Well, coming up, Tricia tells us what to look for when finding the right animal rescue shelter for you. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Calling All Pets website offers you the opportunity to submit email questions, browse pet tips, and find out when Patricia will be in a city near you. Information online at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org. Pet books and training guides are also available through the radio store at 800-747-7444.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And it's time now for this week's topic. And Tricia, there's been a lot of controversy lately about adoption policies at pet shelters. How do we know what to look for in a good shelter or rescue group?
Yeah, lots of controversy. Yeah. Can you spell Ellen DeGeneres?
Yeah.
But, so here's some ideas. First of all, and maybe most importantly, look for a knowledgeable staff, whether it's paid or volunteers. What you want are people who know as much as possible about each individual animal, because what I found is that the most important predictor of a happy pet in a happy family, which is what we all want, is whether the pet and the family are well matched. And, you know, some of them just aren't.
Yeah.
So a good staff can act like good matchmakers and make that happen.
So we should look for a staff that knows a lot about each animal. Makes sense. What else?
Well, ask very detailed questions of them about the particular animal you're thinking about getting. You know, rather than like, is he a good dog or does he like people? Be very specific. Ask really detailed questions like, is the dog shy around unfamiliar men? Or how is the cat around dogs? Or how does this particular dog behave around other female dogs? You know, it might be she's only been with male dogs. A case like that just happened in my office lately. The dog was great with other dogs, except all the other dogs happened to be males. The dog came home to a new household, attacked the other two females. I mean, and so be very specific. You do need to remember, however, that how an animal behaves in a shelter or a foster home isn't always predictive of how they're going to behave in another setting. So that brings up another issue, which are temperament tests. Good shelters are trying to do what they can to use temperament tests to help, again, learn about an animal. They're very controversial. They're predictive in some senses and not in others. But they can be valuable in learning something about a dog's behavior.
Well, it sounds like much of the controversy surrounding the Ellen DeGeneres situation had to do with a return policy of sorts.
It did. And here's the thing to know is that many shelters and rescue groups have a policy that insists that if you're not going to keep the animal yourself, you bring the animal back to the group that you got it from. And, you know, if you think about it, it really, in general, I don't know anything about the specifics of the Ellen DeGeneres case. I don't know the details. But in general, it's a very reasonable policy. It means the group is taking responsibility. When I was a breeder and I sold puppies, that was part of the contract. I had somebody bring a dog back when he was 9 years old.
Oh, and you're kidding.
No, and I took him back with open arms because I knew that was the way I could find that dog. I kept him 3 months, found him a perfect home. So, ironically, some of the smaller or less progressive shelters do the opposite. They say, like, you can't bring this animal back. So it's not an unreasonable policy, but it's a good reminder that if you're going to adopt an animal, be sure you are clear about what their policies are and what requirements they have. Do they require spaying and neutering, for example? Just be aware of what the policies are.
Well, it's obviously a big decision to make when you're adopting a pet. And if you'd like some more information on how to find the right shelter rescue group for you and for a book recommendation from Patricia, visit our website. It's callingallpets.org. And if you have a question for us that you'd like answered, give us a call at 1-800-462-7413. And let's take another call. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Lucy, and I am calling about my 6-year-old Yorkshire Terrier, Maggie.
Lucy, where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Dallas, Texas.
Okay, now what's up with Maggie?
Maggie is the ideal canine companion. She is completely housebroken. She's such a delight to be around. She's not territorial, which can be a problem with some small terriers. She's truly a wonderful member of our family. However, she has one annoying habit that she has developed. She barks at anything that walks past our house.
No.
The postman, squirrels, other dogs, joggers. She did not do this for the first 3 years of her life when we lived in a townhome. We had some foot traffic. She never barked. We moved into a house, and it is just nonstop from the time the 5 a.m. joggers start going in the morning.
Oh, dear.
Oh, dear. We go to bed at night. Well, we're expecting a new baby in about 5 months.
Double deer.
We're a little nervous that this is going to be disruptive, and we'd like to try to address it before the baby comes.
Yeah, there are a couple things you can do. One is see if you can figure out what the trigger is. With some dogs, it's visual, and with other dogs, it's acoustic. And so if it's visual, when you need to with a baby, particularly, you could think about drawing drapes or even keeping your Yorkie out of the front room. Say the baby's napping, you know, and just start a policy where, you know, you little doggy gate, you just don't get to go into that front room where the windows are right by the street where people go by. So part of this is sometimes just maintenance, sort of management kind of issues. So think about how you can do that. The other thing to do is to teach her to stop barking on cue. If you have a dog who barks already, it's actually pretty easy because you teach them to bark on cue, which is going to take you a day. And you don't want to do this, by the way, if your dog doesn't bark, because then you get a dog who starts barking a lot more. I've had a lot of clients who said, well, I taught him to bark on cue, and now he barks all the time. So, but since she does anyway, just when she starts to bark, 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 good girl, bark, bark, good girl, bark, bark, and get a treat in your hand. And when she's not that excited about barking, you know, she barked a little bit, but you're pretty sure she's going to stop anyway because the joggers have gone past. Put that wonderful treat that you have in your fingers right up to her nose as you say, enough. She'll stop barking because her motivation to bark is decreased. And besides, there's, you know, a piece of chicken a quarter of an inch away from her nose, and she's going to be like, whoa, that's more interesting. And it's hard to bark when you're eating that chicken. So basically what you're doing is you're creating a situation where you said enough, and then logistically you fixed it so she stopped barking and got rewarded for it. And then gradually you start expecting her to stop barking when it's a little harder and harder. But I always like to help them. It's very hard for dogs to stop barking when they want to bark. Keep that in mind. It's semi-involuntary. So with my cool hand, Luke, who used to bark a bit, I'd say, Luke, that's enough. And in the early stages of training, I'd say, Luke, that's enough. Luke, Luke. Luke, sit. Luke, lie down. Luke, show me your paw. Luke, look silly. Luke, play bow. Luke, you know, Luke, do this. So I'd give him other things to do.
Pretty soon he was so tired he couldn't bark.
Well, he just, yes. mentally his attention was completely off whatever was outside.
Yeah. Yeah. Understood. So give it a try, Lucy. Thanks a lot for calling.
Thank you. I will definitely give it a try.
All right. Thanks a bunch. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call. You know, Patricia, Elise in Eagle, Idaho, heard our topic on literacy assistance dogs, and it inspired her to write and tell us a story, her story. And here's what she says. My daughter, Marissa, was having problems with reading. Our local libraries have a program called Tales to Tales. T-A-L-E-S to T-A-I-L-S.
Aww.
Yeah, it's a program in which children sign up for a 20-minute reservation to read to a therapy dog, and they can bring their own books or the library will provide material. Very popular program, and my daughter looked forward to these sessions every few months, Elise says. We have two Cavalier King Charles Spaniels, and before they were housebroken, my daughter sat next to the kennel door and read a bedtime story to Rascal and Luke.
Oh, how dear is that?
Yeah, today Rascal sleeps in Marissa's bed, and every night she reads to him under the covers. And thanks to Rascal, Marissa went from not reading at all to reading at her grade level, and it bonded the two at the same time.
Oh,
isn't that a great story?
Oh, I'm just full of oxytocin and feelings of that's just great. Larry, I want to do that when I retire. Really, really. I want to have a
reading. Read to your dogs or?
Yeah, right.
No.
Yeah, no, I want to have a reading therapy dog. I just love that idea. I love reading. I love writing. I love encouraging kids to read and to get into books. And I think we need to be doing that more and more and more. So, yeah, that's an inspiring story. We love it when people send us their stories.
Yeah, we sure do. And how do they do that?
Send us an email to pets@wpr.org.
And if you'd like to join in our conversation here on the program, give us a call at 1-800-462-7413. Someone has done just that. So let us go to the phones. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, my name is Thomas Manning. I'm calling from Norfolk, Virginia.
Tom, thank you very much for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, I have it's probably a 7 or 8 month old kitten, cuter than anything.
Yeah.
But it has this issue. It was actually a rescue. It was obviously weaned from its mother very early, and, you know, it's smaller, and you can tell it was definitely a starving rescue at the time.
Okay.
But she didn't learn how to wean, so now that mother is gone, she actually sucks on her toes when she's, you know, on mommy and daddy's bed, all happy and comfortable.
Yeah. And that's not good for her toes.
And it's just kind of gross and loud, and it's actually, it'll wake us up in the middle of the night.
Oh,
she'll
no
just
kidding.
Be away.
Oh, honey. There are a couple things I do if she was my kitten. I would, and bless your hearts for rescuing her, by the way. That's a wonderful thing you did. I would do a couple things. One is I would get plug-in feel-away, and I would plug it in the bedroom. That's that dispersed pheromone that is based on the pheromones produced by the cheek glands of a cat when they're feeling relaxed and comfy. And it appears, there's some research that suggests that it appears to have a calming effect.
Now, do we smell that, by the way?
No. Don't. Good question, Larry. No, it's a pheromone. You cannot smell it. And you have no conscious. We respond to pheromones as well, although, by the way, you won't respond to this one. They're very species specific. Your dogs won't respond to it. But it appears to have a calming effect on some individuals. And so I would definitely plug that in as close to your bed as you can.
And what was that called again?
It's called Feelaway, F-E-L-I-W-A-Y. You can get it now. It's available pretty much all around pet stores, online. Mm-hmm. Animal behaviorists have it, Good Catteries have it, and your vet clinic might have it. So you can find it pretty easily. So that's one thing I would do. The other thing I would do is see if you can transfer this kind of sort of sucking and kneading behavior at least onto something off her own body, because I'm afraid she's going to hurt her own toes. Get some small, soft plush toys. Put them on the bed. Get your scent on them. Maybe spray some Feel Away on them. Put them next to her. Don't sort of try and force her even to get close to it. Let her, you know how cats are. They don't do well if they're forced into anything. So put it beside her. See if she'll start transferring to that. If she shows some interest in it, you might want to spray her paws with Bitter Apple, which is a safe spray that was designed to discourage licking on a dog or cat's body. It was first designed for after surgery. But it's just bitter, and most dogs and cats don't like it. So you could spray her little paws and then encourage her to try and at least transfer this to something else. But my hope is to feel away, and perhaps time will help decrease her motivation to do it at all.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that sounds like it.
Yeah,
all makes sense.
Give us a try.
Yeah, she's pretty adamant about sucking on her toes when it is time to. It's really hard to, you know, like pull her from the moment.
Yeah, and try to avoid that, because that's not going to be effective. It's just going to make her want to do it more, and it's going to make her want to do it sort of when you're not looking, you know, and then it makes it even more fun. So,
right.
Yeah.
Good luck, Tom.
All right. Thank you very much for your help.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call for you to join in. Their names aren't George Washington or Thomas Jefferson, but in many cases, their work is just as legendary. Conversation about the founding fathers of ornithology is next. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and you are listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Calling All Pets website offers a variety of information, including online archives of the show, pet tips, Patricia's dog training books, and the opportunity to submit email questions. The website is callingallpets.org. Pet books and training guides are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and today we welcome Scott Weidensahl to the program. Scott's latest book is called Of a Feather, A Brief History of American Birding, and he joins us today to talk about it. Scott, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
What do we know about early ornithology in the United States, and in particular, the people who were involved in it? There are some real characters.
Well, there were. I mean, and when you talk about the history of ornithology in North America, you have to sort of preface that by the fact that for tens of thousands of years you had American Indians at this vast store of native ornithology, almost all of which was lost, through war and assimilation and disease. So we're sort of starting about 400 or 500 years ago with the first Europeans to show up in North America. And you're right. I mean, they were an interesting cast of characters. I mean, you had some stalwart noble figures there. You had some real scumbuckets. You know, you had slave merchants and the like. But in the mix of all these people, you had a few folks who paid attention to the natural history and to the bird life of North America. People like John White, who was the first governor of North Carolina, did some wonderful watercolor paintings of some of the early birds. A fellow named Mark Catesby in the early 1700s, another Englishman who came over to this country. John Lawson, who was also in the early 1700s, the surveyor general of the Carolina colony, who, when he wasn't surveying the land and giving the Indians land away to European settlers, was taking note of the bird life. Unfortunately, his day job got the better of him. He ended up being probably burned to death by the Tuscarora Indians in retribution for stealing their land. But before he died, he left a list of more than 136 species of birds, what modern birders would probably call an annotated checklist, kind of a list of what the birds were, what time of the year you saw them, a little bit about their natural history. So some interesting characters in those early days.
And it sounds as though people who came over from England especially were amazed at the bird life here in this country.
Absolutely. I mean, that's one of the consistent themes when you're going through the early accounts of these explorers, is that they were just pretty much all gobsmacked by these birds.
I mean, love just that awestruck phrase, by the way. We don't use that phrase much anymore.
No, it's one of those archaic phrases that pops up. You read too many old colonial accounts, you start using words like gobsmacked. It's an occupational hazard. But no, they were struck by the diversity of the birds here, the sheer abundance of them. I mean, don't forget, in those days we still had passenger pigeon flocks of 2 or 3 billion passenger pigeons moving across eastern North America. We had flocks of native parrots in the east and the southeast, known as Carolina parakeets, that were bright green with fluorescent orange heads like little traffic cones. Greater prairie chickens along the east coast known as heath hens. I mean, it was a tremendous diversity and tremendous abundance of birds. It's kind of amazing to me, not so much that people were amazed by the birds, but that not everybody was. It must have been a staggering thing to see.
And it was certainly staggering to John James Audubon.
Oh, it really was. And in fact, you know, there's this whole series of men. Audubon is one example. Alexander Wilson, William Bartram are others. You know, these young men who were kind of drifting aimlessly through life. I mean, Audubon was the illegitimate son of a French naval captain, came to this country when he was 19 years old. His father hoped that he would learn to manage an estate that his father owned outside of Philadelphia. And instead, Audubon really only cared about dancing and hunting and sport and parties and birds. I I mean, he really became focused on birds, even when he was a failing shopkeeper in the frontier in Kentucky. The same thing had happened some years earlier with Alexander Wilson, who had emigrated here from Scotland as a convicted blackmailer, showed up penniless in Philadelphia, and within a matter of a couple of years was creating the first comprehensive overview of the ornithology of North America, even though when he arrived, he couldn't identify any of the birds here. He was illustrating this book with his own paintings, which he also engraved and hand-colored, even though he had no artistic background, basically taught himself ornithology art and engraving, worked himself into an early grave after about 15 years, but left this incredible legacy in the form of the first comprehensive American ornithology.
You mentioned Audubon loved hunting. I want to go back to that for a minute. And he loved birding, and he seemed to have combined the two in a way. You have a chapter called Shotgun or Ornithology that I think talks about how ornithologists got most of their information at the time.
Well, yeah, and that's something that modern birders, I think, are frequently aghast at, the idea that these early ornithologists were going out and shooting birds. Well, I mean, you have to put yourself in their shoes. They didn't have telephoto lenses. They didn't have binoculars. They didn't have field guides. In fact, they were trying to make sense of this, more than 800 very confusing species of birds in North America. The only way to do that, if you're trying to identify a bird that's high atop a tree in the springtime, is to shoot it and to have it in the hand and to skin it and have the specimen. And so through the 17th and 18th and 19th centuries, the shotgun approach to ornithology was the only way to do it. And it's important today still for scientists to occasionally collect specimens. Most of the specimens they use today are birds that are killed accidentally, but it's still an important part of the science.
And your book brings up an important reminder of how clear things might seem now to us with all field guides we have, but back then there were so many confusions about different ages and sexes of birds, exactly what is a species and what isn't. And part of what I love were all these different names that people used to have. You mentioned in your book alternate names for the common woodcock. What are some of those names?
Oh, well, of course, one that's still used today is timberdoodle, but I mean, Labrador twister and bog sucker and, just all kinds of strange names. The names of birds, particularly in eastern North America, kind of came up through this organic folk process. These were the local names. My great grandfather, who grew up in the late 19th century, did not refer to a song sparrow. He called it a silverthroat because it had such a beautiful call. That was the local name in the mountains of eastern Pennsylvania for a song sparrow. There were dozens and dozens and dozens of names for song sparrows in different parts of the country. What we call a northern flicker today used to be known as a yellowhammer in some area, or as a high holder because it digs its nest hole high up in trees. It wasn't until the late 19th century that those names became codified and formalized. But what's interesting is as you move further and further west, and anybody can notice this going through a field guide, you get more and more names of birds that were named for people. Harris's sparrow, Clark's nutcracker, Lewis's woodpecker, the list goes on and on. And many of these are birds that were first described for science and first named by Westerners, not a farmer sitting on the plow or a hunter in the woods, but a scientist on an expedition in the 19th century.
And the Clark from Clark's Nutcracker, for example, is from Lewis and Clark, right?
Right, exactly, and Lewis's woodpecker. I mean, these were species that Lewis and Clark first collected on their trip west across the Great Plains and the Rockies, brought back, and Alexander Wilson, shortly before his death, as a matter of fact, named both of those birds in honor of Lewis and Clark. They appeared in his American Ornithology. Another species that they discovered on that trip was what was known in those days as the Louisiana tanager, because it was the Louisiana Purchase, what we know today as the Western tanager.
There are a lot of men's names we've been talking about here, but there were some women who really made a huge impact on this field, and one of them was Harriet Lawrence Hemingway. Would you tell us a little bit about her?
That's right. I mean, this is the story of ornithology in 18th and 19th century America, for the most part, is one that's dominated by men. There were a few women. A woman named Grace Anna Lewis, who was born in 1821, was probably the first professional female ornithologist in America. But Harriet Hemingway, the woman you mentioned, she was not an ornithologist. She would have described herself, I think, as a casual bird watcher. But she was enormously important for bird conservation. In the late 19th century, birds were under siege. Wild birds were under siege from market hunting for the table. I mean, you could shoot not just game species, but people were shooting shorebirds and songbirds like bobolinks and robins and serving them in the finest hotels. And particularly for the millinery trade, for the fashion trade, they were shooting birds, especially herons and egrets, which in the springtime get these enormously long, gauzy, extremely elegant breeding plumes called egrettes that were used to decorate women's hats. And as many as 200 million birds a year were being killed for the millinery trade. And then in 1896, along comes Harriet Hemingway. She was absolutely at the pinnacle of Boston society. Her blood was about as blue as it's possible for a person to be. And she decided to use society to save birds. She and her cousin began to draw up a list of all the women of Boston society and invite them to join a new group that they were calling the Massachusetts Audubon Society, to pledge themselves to stop the slaughter of birds. And they were able to tap in to, I think, a degree of high society snobbishness. And also, there was a vibrant women's club movement across the country in the late 19th century. And Hemingway and her Audubon Society were able to say, look, ladies, if you want to claim the high moral ground here, you can't be prancing around with the plumes of slaughtered birds on your head. And by the 1920s, you had a whole raft of federal and state regulations, most of which are still in effect and still provide the framework, the basic legal framework for the protection of wild birds. They were able to shut down the millinery trade. They were able to shut down market hunting for these species. And it really was the bedrock of wild bird conservation in America.
How do you feel about the methods of ornithology that are practiced today?
What's happened is, you know, ornithology in the late 19th and early 20th century became this very formal science. But at the same time, you also had the growth in the sport of birds, in bird watching and birding as we know it today. And the two have kind of split apart and come together a number of times over the years. And what I find really fascinating today is the way both of them are kind of curving back together again. The professional ornithologists recognize that you have this cadre of tens of millions of enthusiastic, experienced birders out there who are, you know, capable of producing all kinds of data that a scientist never in a million years would have the money or the time to try to produce. And birders are recognizing that you can do, you know, call it citizen science if you want to, or birding with a purpose. But the idea of using what you do as a hobby to further the conservation and management and understanding of birds. And so we have things like Project Feeder Watch, which is administered out of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, and Bird Studies Canada, where hundreds of thousands of people across North America every winter monitor the birds at their backyard feeder. And you pool all that information together, and you get this incredible snapshot of winter bird populations that show rises and falls in the populations of some birds. We've been able to track the advance of certain bird diseases across the country that way. Yeah, it's a great way to have fun and do good for the birds and do good science all at the same time.
Scott, a real pleasure to talk with you today. I appreciate it very much.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. And I think we'll put up on our website the web addresses of some of those places where people can go and see what's going on. There are some great, they're fascinating websites.
Some great ways to get involved in bird conservation, and a wonderful family project, too.
Scott, again, thank you. Scott Wydenzahl is the author of A Feather, A Brief History of American Birding. He joined us today from the studios of WITF in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Stay tuned. Our animal trivia question of the week is next, with your chance to win a copy of Scott's book. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
If you missed an episode of Calling All Pets, the show is available online. Our website offers archives of the show, along with the opportunity to submit email questions, browse pet tips, and learn more about a guest you heard on the program. More information available online at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org.
You're listening to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller, along with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And now it's time for our animal trivia question of the week. And if you think you know the answer to this week's question, give us a call at 1-800-462-7413. All correct guessers will have their names pooled together, and two winners will be selected at random to win a copy of a Feather by Scott Wiedensahl. And here's today's question. In his book, Scott writes about a phenomenon that took place in the late 19th century known as the Sparrow Wars. The debate over the Sparrow Wars were over the popular fad of bringing foreign birds to North America, especially those from Europe. Among the most popular bird species brought to America were the skylark and this other passerine bird, which today is the national bird of Iran and Bangladesh. What bird is this? You know what? I can't remember. I'll get it, though. But if you want to tell us your answer, give us a call at 1-800-462-7413. And to find out if you're right, check out our website. In about a week, we'll have the correct answer posted online at callingallpets.org. And Tricia? Guess it's time to take some more calls.
I think it is.
Let's do that. Here's the number again, 1-800-462-7413. And here's our next caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Ann in Madison, Wisconsin.
Ann, what's up with you?
Well, first I wanted to tell you that I listen with my two cats, Simpson and Trixie, every week to Calling All Pets.
Oh, good kitties.
And good Ann.
And good Ann.
I gather them around and we all listen. I wanted to ask you about keeping dogs in crates when owners have to work during the day. And as a cat lover and a cat person, I don't have dogs of my own, but I do know people who keep their dogs in crates. And being kind of claustrophobic myself, it seems to me to be, first, a little bit cruel. And second, if there's an emergency, the dog is trapped in the crate. He or she can't bark out a window. There's no stimulation. Accidents can happen, which is kind of unpleasant for the dog and the owner. And I was wondering whether a smallish room with nothing in it that's valuable that can be chewed might not be a better solution than a crate for, say, 8 hours.
I'm so glad you're asking. It's a really good question, and I should tell you that right now I have three dogs, and one of them, the 15-month-old Border Collie, is in a crate right now. He loves his crate. He adores it. He often goes into it by himself, chooses to be there. Whenever I say, go to bed or crate up, he runs right in it, and he's there because he's young. He's just too young to leave loose in the house right now.
Yeah.
And it's not safe for my house, frankly, and it's not safe for him either. My older dogs are loose. And I think share with you a belief that ideally everybody's dog would be loose in the house. But there are several things I want to talk about. Basically, the bottom line is that it really depends on the dogs. Some dogs are truly, and I say this based on 20 years of experience, are truly happier in a crate. You know, you say there's little stimulation there. One of the things that some dogs suffer from is overstimulation. They go crazy. They can look out the window. People go by. They're either, I don't know what they're thinking. I wonder if some of them think they need to protect the house from the people who pass by. But they can bark all day long. They work themselves up into frenzies. And they honestly and truly seem to be more content and relaxed and happy if you restrict that kind of stimulation. Stimulation is not always good. Now, does that mean every dog is okay in a crate? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Dogs have to be trained to be comfortable in crates. You know, the old saying that dogs are den animals. Well, they're den animals when they're having babies. You know, dogs don't naturally always adore being in crates. And so it's definitely something that can be abused or misused. And I've seen that happen far too many times, animals who are basically neglected and sort of left in crates almost most of their life, and I think that's truly abusive. On the other hand, I think crates are a godsend for some animals. Willie and I just went to a herding dog clinic. We were out of town. We were gone for 4 days, and he was in his crate in the car. It's like his little traveling bedroom. you know,
yeah.
So it provided familiarity to him. So crates are can be the best thing that ever happened to your dog, but they can also be misused. And so I think it's good to be thoughtful about how they're being used.
And, you know, we've got an email question that really relates exactly to this from Lori in Madison, Wisconsin. And here's what she writes. She says, I have a 9-month-old Springer Spaniel puppy that's crate trained, meaning that since we got him from a rescue group at 3 months of age, he has stayed in a dog crate when he's home alone. I'm trying to uncrate him to allow him a little more freedom in just one room of the basement, but it's not going well. When I leave for work in the morning, I put him in his crate, give him a treat, close the crate door without latching it, and then I leave. He'll stay in his crate for a while, but then he'll spend hours running up and down the basement stairs, barking and howling. How do I know this? Because I installed a webcam on the computer in that room and can hear and see him from my work computer through a Skype connection.
I love it.
He has to spend about 6.5 hours alone per day during the work week. Is he just too young for that freedom, or am I trying to do too much?
I think he's too young. Was it 9 months? Wasn't that dog 9 months old? It's too young. It's too young. Now, I would want to know what the dog is doing in the crate. If the dog is howling in the crate, then we might be talking about a dog who has separation anxiety. But if the dog is comfortable and quiet and relaxed in the crate, but is running around barking and causing all kinds of sort of trouble, household trouble, then 9 months is really, really young. I just left Willie. I drove away from the house for about 20 minutes. That's the first time I've left him alone, loose in the house, outside of the crate, when I drove away. But I was only gone 20 minutes, and he was 15 months old, and he's, you know, starting to sort of get over that little hump. So I think in the particular case of the person who emailed us, too soon. 9 months old is very young.
And for Ann's question about a large room or just a room as opposed to the crate, what do you think about
that? You know, that works really well for some dogs. There are some dogs, by the way, who are phobic about crates, and they hate being in there. They're terrified in there. And if you take them out of the crate and give them, you know, we didn't used to crate dogs. You know, we used to put them in the laundry room or, you know, in a room like Ann is describing. And that does work really well for some dogs. But some dogs don't settle down. They overstimulate themselves. They're comfier and they feel safer. You know, a lot of dogs, especially if you have a crate that's covered on the top and it does feel sort of cozy and denny and bedroom-like, a lot of dogs tend to feel safer and quieter. So again, it really depends on the dog. But if you're going to create that small room, what a lot of people do, regrettably, Anne, is they'll pick a room where nobody ever goes. You know, it's the laundry room in the basement or something. And the dog doesn't appear to be comfortable because it's not a room that anybody uses, you know. So the trick is you want your dog in a room that smells comfortable and familiar. But again, crates are not can be a godsend for some dogs. But it depends on the dog and depends on how you use them.
Ann, thanks a lot for calling. And Lori, thanks a lot for that email question. And again, for people to send us an email.
Oh, we love it. Please send us your ideas or your questions to pets@wpr.org. And you know, you can check out our website as well, callingallpets.org.
And if you're like Ann and want to talk to us on the phone, give us a call at 1-800-462-7413. And here's another caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Chris from Juneau, Alaska.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for calling.
Hi there. Well, I'm calling with, I think it might be somewhat a common problem with our dog. In early August, our daughter went away to college, and about a month later, we just started noticing a big difference in her demeanor, our dog's demeanor, not our daughter's. she's just sad, and we're just wondering, you know, what it is we might be able to do to help this. When my daughter calls from school, we put the cell phone up to the dog's ear.
Yeah.
She gets a little excited, but she's a disembodied voice.
Right. It's just
not
the same. It's just not the same. You know, there is research that looks at social attachments in lots of different species of animals, and we know that animals have some of the same hormonal changes and some of the same changes in neurotransmitters and some of the same sort of brainwave activity when they're separated from someone that they're really attached to. A lot of what we understand about social attachment actually comes from non-human mammals. So there's every reason to believe that your dog is missing your daughter and is depressed what we would call depressed, because she's missing someone she's really attached to. And so in one sense, there is, you know, regrettably, there is no magic cure, because some other person isn't going to be your daughter. Although I have known a couple of cases in which there was a substitute, in that somebody found a neighbor girl who was a relative, who was the same age, you know, also a young girl who loved dogs, and who became an addition to the family. So along with mom and dad, there was a neighbor girl who came and played with the dog and walked the dog. And that seemed to help a little bit. The other thing I would do, time does help tremendously, as in most species, in most cases. But, you know, the other thing I would do, I love that your dog is getting all this exercise. I would also add in, play some fun games with your dog. Teach your dog discrimination games, like, you know, get your squirrel, not your rabbit, or you know, teach her some fun tricks, just really fun silly tricks, from lie down, you know, and roll over, or wrap a blanket around your head. There's a trick you can teach a dog to lie down.
She'll do anything for us, because she's not my husband's dog. That my husband is her boy, is the way we always say. She'll do anything for him.
and so if, you know, both of you are sort of adding to her repertoire and what she does that's really sort of fun and silly and giggly, that can be really helpful too. And tricks are like that, you know, they're not like obedience exercises. You know, so have some fun with that.
Thank you very much for calling, Chris.
Thank you.
Appreciate it very much. You know, Patricia, I'm a little sad, but I'm happy too. I'm sad because the show's over, but I'm happy that we'll be back next week.
Well, I'll see what tricks I can teach you in between shows, Mueller.
Thanks,
stay tuned.
Patricia McConnell is a PhD certified applied animal behaviorist and adjunct associate professor of zoology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And she's here every week to give you practical advice about your pet's behavior. Calling All Pets is produced by Wisconsin Public Radio. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Our producer, Cynthia Schuster. Brad Kohlberg is our technical director. And Leo Sidran composed our theme music. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, hoping you'll join us again next time for more Calling All Pets.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 1117P. More pet tips and advice for training new dogs or leaving pets home alone are available online at callingallpets.org. Our website also features a complete list of past guests and online archives of the program. The website, once again, is callingallpets.org.